The words we live by. The National Broadcasting Company and its affiliated independent stations present The Words We Live By, the summer series of the Eternal Light program, which comes to you under the auspices of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. Today we present Wisdom Books of the Bible, the third in this series of 15 outstanding literary dialogues of past years, featuring Mark Van Doren and Maurice Samuel, two of America's foremost men of letters. Mr. Samuel.
Mark, there's so much to talk about in the book of Proverbs, and there are so many brilliant and pointed observations there that I think you'll agree with me, we are just suffering from an embarrassment of riches, and we'll just have to be brutal with ourselves and skip a good deal of the material if we intend to cover the wisdom literature more or less. But let's, for this week, let's still stick to the book of Proverbs and see what we can distill out in the course of the next half hour.
Well, Maurice, just in that connection, I might say that during this week I have considered the book of Proverbs again and have come to the conclusion that it quite rightly belongs where it is. That is to say, it is the master book of all these books.
Do you think so? I've often...
Yes, I really think...
When
we
come to the book Ecclesiasticus, I might challenge that, but I can understand your point of view.
Well, there are wonderful things in Ecclesiasticus and wonderful things in the Ethics of the Fathers, but it's a good thing to learn that a book which is supposed to be the best book, after all, is. It's a very interesting and very humbling experience. One has it all the time. This book oftentimes talks about things that are obvious enough, I suppose. The author or authors of the book of Proverbs don't like drunkenness, do they? Wine is a mocker, strong drink is raging or riotous, and whosoever reeleth thereby is not wise. Anyone understands this, of course. It has always been understood. The foolish man not only is an easily angry man, a man who never can be corrected, a man who is sullen, uncheerful, unhappy, sour, glum, for no reason, except that he is not wise. He also is likely to be, he also could be, a glutton and a drunkard. So gluttony and drunkenness are both pretty heavily inveighed against. Now, as I say, there's nothing astonishing about this.
It's put with a neatness that is memorable, as in the passage when he asks, who has red eyes? Who gets into trouble? Who gets his neck broken? Yeah. The man who drinks. And yet observe, as you have observed, how King Lemuel, the last of the contributors to the book of Proverbs, says, it is not for kings to drink, nor for princes to say, where is strong drink? Give strong drink to him that is ready to perish, and wine unto the bitter in soul. Let him drink and forget his poverty and remember his misery no more. Now, that's a very extraordinary thing, isn't it? This is to say that when men reach a certain stage of hopelessness, well, let him forget it. Let him drown his sorrow in drink. That is apparently something that the wise King Lemuel, whom some identify, by the way, with Solomon, accepted. Apparently in contradiction to the other point of view, and perhaps not if you reach a stage where a man has no hope whatsoever, well, then let it go.
Yes, well, I think it's the part of wisdom to recognize such a crisis in any human life. It is pity, it is mercy. In that case, to say, let him have his forgetfulness. But drunkenness for the sake of it, drunkenness that means nothing, that cures nothing, that helps helps out no soul in its difficulty, is simply declared a bad thing. I brought up this point merely in order to say that oftentimes the Proverbs are not dark. They're not mysterious. They don't have to be interpreted. Everybody understands at once what they mean. I've been interested also in the type of saying here, which is astonishingly mundane. For instance, such as this, diverse weights and diverse measures, both of them alike, are an abomination to the Lord. The attribution to the Lord of an interest in in commercial trickery. Interests me a great deal. I think it's sound, actually. I think the liar, the thief, the man who deceives tradesman who deceives his customers is a bad man.
There's an instance, Mark, I think, of that distinction we were discussing last week or a couple of weeks ago. I can't imagine a Greek saying so intimately that Zeus is watching you when you weigh out a bag of sugar. He might say Zeus hates lying and untruth and cheating, but he wouldn't come down to this picture of God being actually pleased when a man keeps right measures and right weights.
Incidentally, diverse weights and diverse measures, I take it means a different set of weights.
That's for, right.
When you're buying when you are selling.
Yes, yes, it must mean that. And it must mean something else, too. That some simpleton comes in, you use another set of measures, another set of weights. But now that you've referred, Mark, to these dark sayings and these contradictions, there is a contradiction, or an apparent contradiction, which is not in the text itself directly, but emerges from the text. And that is the relationship or the attitude toward women in the book of Proverbs. On the one hand, the writer or the writers, because they speak, they're different contributors, seem to be terrified of women and conceive of women as the some sort of dragon of the prime whose presence is almost invariably the precursor of a man's damnation. And yet at the same time, over and over again, we are told that the man who does evil shames not only his father but his mother. It says, a wise son maketh a glad father, but a foolish man despiseth his mother. Hear, my son, the instruction of thy father, and forsake not the law of thy mother. A wise son makes a glad father, but a foolish son is the grief of his mother. And so on over and over again. There's a deep contradiction there. You find King Solomon saying in Ecclesiastes, when we'll get to that book, that he has found among 1,000 men one good man, but among 1,000 women not even one good woman. There is here this contradiction. How would you resolve it?
Well, in the very simple way that I always do. We cannot get along with women, and we cannot get along without them.
Oh, in other words, the contradiction is part of life.
Oh, I'm afraid it is. We all, men like to say terrible things about women, and even those very men who say those terrible things know that they are indebted to them for almost everything that they have. There's a suggestion that, of course, if you're seriously interested in the truth about the world, Maurice, you will not waste much time talking with women. The Ethics of the Fathers says at one point, do not gossip with women. This has been said even with regard to one's own wife. How much more does it apply to another man's wife? Hence the sages say, whoever gossips with women brings harm to himself, for he neglects the study of the Torah and will in the end inherit Gehinnom. Which is a very serious saying, because, as I understand, that place that you will inherit is a place where unspeakable crimes had been committed.
Yes, are being expiated.
Human sacrifice and all that.
But it's difficult to interpret in our modern language the meaning of these phrases. There is, for instance, a phrase also in the Ethics of the Fathers that if a man is studying and he interrupts himself to the extent of saying, look at that beautiful tree, he has forfeited his soul.
Yes.
Now, if you're going to take that literally, it makes nonsense of the saying itself. It is in a certain context. It means that if you are studying, don't be distracted from the study by any aesthetic momentary passing incident.
Yes, for instance, some aesthetic interest in a particular tree as a tree. George Herbert, the English poet of the 17th century, whom I like so much, counsels himself against resting in nature and not the God of nature. It's an ancient notion that we should consider everything not in terms of its own beauty or its own form, but in terms of our wonder at who made it. There is a difference,
yes,
of course.
Yeah, that is the meaning there, and that some such interpretation must be made, Mark, of the sayings about the women, both in the Ethics of the Fathers and in the wisdom literature of the Bible, because it's quite obvious from the dozen references or more to the honor which a man owes to his mother to behave for her sake, that she played a tremendous role in his education, and that she was considered one of the pivots of his life.
Of course.
So that some mode of correction of this outlook must be found. And I want to repeat what I said last week, that we've probably lost a great deal of the meaning of these things because the circumstances which were their sounding board and which provided the significant resonance and overtones for them, these things have disappeared. I was thinking, if you take one of the neatest writers in the English language, say Pope, who has given us in his essay on man and the epistle, Dr. Arbuthnot, some of the finest phrases in English,
yeah,
and you try to translate them into another language or try to paraphrase them, they don't make sense. You remember that phrase of his, something about those write well, good writing comes by art, not chance, as those
move
easiest
who have learned
to dance.
That's right.
Now, there's a neatness there. If you try to paraphrase it, doesn't make sense. I remember when I was at school in England as a boy, they used to have a silly exercise, of paraphrasing a poet, putting it into your own language, which meant you actually destroyed all the content.
Yes, that is perfectly true, and the brilliance of these proverbs is a brilliance oftentimes of metaphor, of translation. To go back to the women just for a minute, perhaps we have not altogether lost wisdom in our time, because it is a common saying among us that it is unwise to underestimate the power of a woman. You know, everybody hears that phrase.
Oh, everybody hears it, and I bet a lot of money was paid to the man who invented that for the advertising.
But I take it that the apparently contradictory views of women here are capable of reconciliation. After all, they are all paying tribute to the enormous power of women to destroy men or to make them. Their mothers make them. But other women can unmake them. Of course, the Book of Proverbs ends with a very famous celebration of the good wife.
Yes, yes.
Of the good woman.
Mark, I have an idea for you. You have students, of course, who submit their theses, PhD theses, to you.
Yes.
And do you ever suggest theses to any of the students?
I have.
I suddenly thought of one. Or rather, I remembered it. I thought of it a long time ago. On the question of the position of the woman in the Bible, suppose you got one of your students to make a comparison of the number of women included in the Encyclopedia Britannica as having had careers in the modern world and the number of women that he will find in the Bible as having had careers of their own, and make a comparison of the two in order to discover, statistically as it were, the relative positions of women in genuine matters of importance in the biblical world and in the modern world.
And he would find a very high ratio of important women in the biblical world.
I think higher than in the Encyclopedia Britannica.
Oh, I think so. He would find Sarah, Rebecca, Rachel,
Deborah, the...
even Jezebel.
Jezebel, it was a career of a kind.
Oh, of course. And Esther and Ruth. Oh, it's really remarkable.
Now, to get back to those phrases, the majority of them do come out magnificently in English. This one, for instance, he that sendeth a message by the hand of a fool cutteth off his own feet and drinketh damage. I don't think you could improve on that.
No, that's right. I was interested in thinking about the proverbs that deal with life that is lived hour by hour in the world. I was thinking also, in addition to the proverbs that have to do with weights and measures, a number of them that caution you, indeed warn you, almost as if it had, as if the warning had divine meaning, against going surety for a neighbor, or as we used to say, signing a note for somebody. It's the same thing, isn't
it? Yes, of course.
Now, when I first came upon that in the proverbs, reading it the very first time I went over it for our present purpose, It seemed to me rather odd. It didn't seem to me very important. It didn't seem to me, surely, that God would be very much interested in the question of whether or not you went on somebody's note. But upon considering it further, and upon reading also discussions of the matter, Maurice, I have come to the conclusion that it's not a trivial consideration, because to go on someone's note and lose your own fortune, to lose your own property, is to destroy yourself. It might be to destroy yourself. And that is not only a foolish thing, it might even be a wicked thing, because you cease to have any power for good in the world. You have wantonly, as it were, and without thought, somehow risked all that you had for someone else.
Yes, the same thought, the same admonition or warning appears again in Ecclesiasticus. There seems to have been a class of men who thoughtlessly or in that kind of irresponsible generosity which is impulsive but not genuine, simply said, I'll go bail, I'll go surety for so-and-so, and you're warned. Why should you do this and have your bed sold from underneath you, which is the phrase they use?
Now, I'm sure the suggestion is that there could be a situation in which you would give everything you had for somebody to save your father, your brother, or your son. And everyone understands that that might be a very glorious thing to do. But just sort of casually to risk your well-being for someone who will go under and take you under with him is not to do any good in the world, because instead of one man disappearing, two men disappear. Now, I suspect that it has some fundamental importance. I might say that in my youth in Illinois, I often heard it said of such and such a man that he had gone on a note for someone. That was the phrase, to go on a note.
Yes.
It means to sign a note, to say that you will be responsible for his debt, which he maybe will not be able to pay. Such and such a man did that once, and therefore, and thereafter was an unhappy man, because he lost his farm, or he lost his shop, he lost everything he had. And I remember then, I used to hear my father say such things, my uncles tell about such things. And the suggestion always was that the man was, to be sure, to be pitied, but to be pitied partly as a fool.
Yes, there is a calculated fine generosity, and there's the generosity of the man who doesn't know what he's doing. It's a sound wisdom that speaks in that.
You know, I might tell you of a man that we discussed here several years ago, because we've been talking almost through eternity, haven't we, about these matters?
Well, a lustrum is what they call it.
Well, the author of the great Joseph books, Thomas Mann, someone who knew Mann very well, said that as a relatively young man, he was married, but he was still young, he was approached one day by a friend of his who was in deep trouble and who needed a good deal of money. Mann gave him that money. The sum was not stated. And only in after years did that other man learn that Mann had given him all he had.
I have not heard that. It's extraordinary.
It's amazing.
Story. Yes, it is.
It meant that Mann thereafter for weeks, months, had to struggle to get together money to live by, to pay his bills. To live at all.
Well, that was a wonderful thing.
Mann did not tell him that, yes, incidentally.
Yes, and that sort of thing is not frowned on in the wisdom literature.
Oh, by no means.
It's the other kind where, as you suggested before, two are ruined instead of one man bearing the consequences
also,
of his own action.
Also, Maurice, it might be an act of vanity. Don't you think so? You might be might want to be known as a good fellow.
There is something in that. It's certainly one thing may be said of a man who goes shorty. He can't do it secretly.
That's
the one thing that you cannot hide from somebody else.
And you may do it with a certain swagger. Sure, sure, I'll say.
But all, yes. But it's also recognized, the wisdom books do recognize, however, the element of egotism in what we call goodness. You take a saying of this kind. Rejoice not when thine enemy falleth, and let not thy heart be glad when he stumbleth, which is very wonderful, and goes on to say, lest the Lord see it, and it displease him, and he turn away his wrath from him.
From him?
From that other man.
Yes.
In other words, don't crow because it might lead to a reversal of the situation, and you'll be laughing on the wrong side of your face.
Yes.
So an element of prudence, or even of cunning, is thrown into a genuinely moral statement.
Well, and with a religious reference.
Yes.
Because God, again, is listening. God, again, is watching. And this might put teeth or bite into the old statement that we should not judge other men.
It makes God rather human, by the way, doesn't it?
Of course it does. But it is God's role to judge men. And when we judge a man in that bitter sense in which is suggested here, God might become angry and say that we are overplaying our...
Yes.
Our part.
Well, there is a...
He said, I'll show you how to judge him. I'll save him.
Yes. There's a wonderful saying in the Ethics of the Fathers about, first of all, there is a statement, never judge a man until you have been in his position. And then there's another saying there, if you... It's usually translated as, judge a man in the scale of merit. Actually, what it means is, when you judge your neighbor, weight the scale in his favor.
Yes.
Not merely give him the benefit of the doubt, but add something. You may have overlooked one of his good points.
Yes.
So judge him for the better.
You know, speaking of judgment, judgment, of course, now not before the Lord, but in the affairs of men, there's a terribly realistic proverb in the 18th chapter. He that pleadeth his cause first seemeth just, but his neighbor cometh and searcheth him out. That is to say, wait until you've heard both sides. The first man who speaks always sounds as if he had all the truth on his side. It's his story, as we say.
Yes.
But wait. Yeah. The Ethics of the Fathers has a very amusing, not so much amusing, but pungent remark there. As a judge, consider both men who are before you guilty. After they have listened to your judgment, and they have left you, consider both of them innocent.
Yes.
I think
it's
a very sweet saying.
Yes, it is. If they've accepted the judgment, well, then they are sinless.
They are
but
clear.
Your observation reminds me of something that Weizmann used to tell, the late Dr. Chaim Weizmann, used to tell about his father, who was a very highly regarded man in the townlet of Mottola, where Weizmann grew up. People would come to him as the wise man of the village to settle their disputes, and Weizmann recalls that his father used to have this attitude. A man would come to him, full of complaints against somebody, and old Weizmann would listen very carefully. When the man had finished, he would say, "Good, I've heard your story. From what you tell me, you're obviously in the wrong. Now I'm waiting for the other man to come. I'll see if maybe he'll put you in the right."
Yeah. You know, what do you think of all the proverbs that have to do with the rearing of children? Of course, there is the relatively harmless proverb that says, train up a child in the way he should go, and even when he is old, he will not depart
well,
from it.
Well, it is harmless, but there's something more than that. They did recognize the permanence of the pattern in which is impressed in youth as being a lifetime condition.
Yes, just as, remember, your friend Alexander Pope once said, just as a twig is bent, the tree is inclined.
Yes.
And we all know that. Once a character is formed, whether or not by the parents or by the child himself, it tends to stay in that form. But the proverbs go on in a number of cases to suggest that training a child in the way he should go is not a permissive technique, to use a phrase of our time. The rod should be used from time to time. The child should be corrected and should be given his form, sometimes in a pretty bitter fashion. Have you any feeling about that? Do you think that this is just old-fashioned
stuff?
Well,
Mark, we're both fathers with grown-up children. I'm a grandfather. Are you, by the way?
No.
Not yet.
I'm sorry.
You'll shortly be a grandfather.
I hope so.
And you may have another attitude toward the grandchildren than you have toward your own children. I've always said that it's much nicer being a grandfather. You have all the delight and none of the diapers.
And you have no responsibility.
And you have no responsibility, so perhaps you can afford to be much more kindly with the grandchildren than you were with the children. My feeling is that the emphasis that's been placed upon the purely argumentative side, especially for very young children, is a false one. If there is any truth at all in the theory of the reflex action, to teach a child to associate a misdemeanor or a folly with some immediate painful consequence, I don't mean a brutal consequence, but enough of pain or distaste there to form an instinctive aversion for the wrong thing, well, I don't see how else one can actually do it. I have the same feeling with regard to the general tendency in education in which the element of discipline has been so badly weakened that merely to refer to it, Mark, is already looked upon as a sign of a primitive mentality or of a reactionary mood. There's a good deal in this statement, spare the rod and spoil the child. If it has been abused, and it has been, no question about it, if it has been abused, we can correct that.
And the other thing can be abused, too. The opposite can be.
Yes, I believe that it has been abused a great deal, and it's very easy to be sentimental and to talk of the reasonableness of the child. A child is not reasonable. A young child is a little animal, is a little savage, who has to be loved and corrected. And he says, he that loveth his son chasteneth him.
Of course, you wouldn't approve, probably, of what Benvenuto Cellini did to his son, do you? Or what his father had done to him, I believe. Cellini tells about it in his autobiography. Once there was a salamander that went across the pavement, and Cellini's father showed it to him and beat him so that he would remember, always remember having seen a salamander.
Well, first of all, I hope no, I don't share that attitude.
No.
But Benvenuto Cellini was not noted for the accuracy of his statements.
No.
With regard to himself or with regard to anybody else.
I'm sure not.
But quite right, I wouldn't advocate that method because the association with salamander and beating would be altogether beside the point with regard to the information itself.
You know, every now and then the proverbs sound a little bit cynical. For instance, this one, every man is a friend to him that giveth gifts.
Well, is it cynical,
no,
or is it a warning?
Maybe.
It is a warning, and it is something that puts you on your guard. The man who has a great many friends, Mark, you've got to ask, how did he achieve his popularity? There is a famous advertisement which has always made my hackles rise. I haven't seen it of late, but it was current for a long time. Such popularity must be deserved. You remember it?
Yes, yes.
Well, deserved for what?
Yes.
And that is what we're warned against in that statement. I'm sorry, Mark. I think we'll have to go into the more general fields. Just discussing these individual statements, each one of which could be made the subject of a long essay.
Well, next week, however, let's do take a look at the book of Ecclesiasticus, which has not only certain very famous phrases in it, many people don't know they're there, but has that marvelous long lyrical rhapsody on famous men.
Yes, I'm going to ask you to read that out next week.
I should like
before
to.
Before we discuss it, because it is one of the great literary passages in sacred and semi-sacred literature.
And a poet of our time has a famous poem. Let us now praise famous men.
Yes.
You have just heard The Words We Live By, the third in the 15-week Eternal Light summer series. We invite you to join us again next week for another in this series of outstanding literary dialogues of past years, featuring Mark Van Doren and Maurice Samuel. Our program will be the fourth of five, entitled Wisdom Books of the Bible. Words We Live By is produced under the auspices of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. This pre-recorded program has been an NBC Public Affairs presentation.
Henry Cabot Lodge will be the guest on Meet the Press. Today on NBC Radio.